to the protest on Friday night, you know, to show my support towards the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, against police brutality. The protest was peaceful. The cops started stampeding towards the crowd, and I noticed that peaceful protesters were getting hurt. Like, it was a scene straight out of a horror movie, something that you wouldn't expect. I knew how important it was to record things like that, so I took my camera out to start recording, and there's a video on Twitter of the recording that I took where I'm running backwards in the direction the officers are telling us to go to, and I'm trying to record while running backwards. And Officer Vincent D'Andrea and his commander, Craig Edelman, they're walking in my direction, and Vincent D'Andrea tells me to move. And I asked why while still moving in the direction he was telling me to go to, and he smacked my phone out of my hand. And then he called me what he called me, and before I could put my arms up to block myself from the lunge I could see out of my peripheral vision, he shoved me very hard to the ground.
I'm going to show that video of you being shoved for a particular reason, because we don't like to repeat video. But I want people to be able to see, as he pushes you, he is not alone, as you said. He's next to a commanding officer. And many others walk past you as this happens, in the same way we saw happen with Martin Gugino, or Gugino in Buffalo, an entire, it looked like, battalion.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Here.
We are all here. Good morning. This is More Talk Radio coming at you at KBOO.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. I am Celeste Carey. I'm here with my co-host, Cecil Prescott. How are you doing this morning, Cecil?
Hey, I am doing well in spite of the, you know, shake up, you know, with the air and, you know, but that's just normal
for life.
Monday
gremlins.
Yeah.
But well, hey, we still have them.
Did you hear the, you know, it's June, and in June is when the Supreme Court makes its final decisions for the year.
Yeah.
And in a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that Title VII, 1964 legislation about job discrimination, it ruled 6-3 that the workers cannot be fired for being gay, lesbian, or transgender.
Yes, which is interesting. Because Trump just took away health benefits.
Well, yeah. And it's interesting, with 6-3, so the Supreme Court Justice Roberts ruled, but also one of Trump's appointees, Neil Gorsuch, ruled in favor of that. So a bit of good news in the midst of all of this.
And good news really is important right about now, because with all that's going on, there seems to be just more turmoil everywhere you turn. And our show today is a comparison and contrast of a sort of ways of kind of being not only self-actualized, but based on an article that I read in a conservative magazine. Yes, I try to read and look at everything. The magazine is the National Review. And so I shared this with Cecil because on reading it, I was kind of thrown off. It's like, oh, wow, is this really where they're coming from? The article deals with the concept of backlash against these protests for fair treatment under the law, for basic respect of human life, and all of that. And so what was your thought about it as I'm pulling this up, because all of a sudden, my big computer just totally died on me.
Well, yeah,
what did you think of that article?
Yeah, I found the argument confusing, and I couldn't quite understand. I could not understand it completely. One thing I did gain from it was part of a conversation I've been having with many people talking about this Kairos moment where. At this time in our nation's history, things seem to be in turmoil, and there seems to be things that are changing. And at that, and part of my conversations I've been having with a number of people, that is, it isn't as if all of a sudden those who have been the oppressors, white supremacy or capitalism, is going to say, oh, okay, game's over, I'm going to take home my marbles and go home. But there will be an inevitable backlash, and that we have to prepare for how the oppressors will respond in part. I am encouraged and enthused by the outpouring of passion and movement, really radical movement. One could not have thought, just think, for example, in terms of those who have been working in terms of police reform, police abolition, and the amount of work that's been going on, changes, real changes that have happened in cities throughout the nations in terms of reorganizing and rethinking of police, and that has taken place in the last 2 to 3 weeks, is simply amazing. And I celebrate that. But also I'm aware of that there will be an inevitable backlash of this, and that we have to be prepared for it and be very strategic in terms of how we respond, and also to be thinking in the future about what will happen next and how will we prepare for it. I'm also reminded of the fact that we need to celebrate and to be hopeful, but we also need to be cautious and aware of things that takes place. So it's a long way of saying that I think what the article said in part was that there is an inevitable backlash and that we need to be prepared for it. But I may have read it all wrong and was just reading what I wanted to read in it. Give me some wisdom.
I don't think you were reading it wrong. I don't think so at all. As a matter of fact, this article in the National Review, it was written June 11th, by Jim Garrity, G-E-R-A-G-H-T-Y. It's called, the article is under the Morning Jolt, and indeed it was. The backlash is coming, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. And I think the reason you didn't quite grasp it is because it does have a little convoluted reasoning in some ways. I find sometimes that some of these arguments against the protest and the protesters are not always honest. They're disingenuous, and sometimes they do some mental gymnastics to prove their point. On the menu today,
who is that?
In the street. Some of the protesters in the street seem quite convinced that violence will intimidate the rest of society into giving them what they want. That is as historically ignorant as their decision to deface statues of abolitionists in the name of racial justice. This is the article by Jim Garrity. The 90s were a different time, kids, it says. It was a kind of era where in the aftermath of horrifying riots in Los Angeles, David Alan Greer and Jim Carrey could appear in a sketch on the comedy program in Living Color as beating victims. Rodney King and Reginald Denny, and declare staying in school and staying off drugs is fine, but it ain't going to do you any good if you don't have sense enough to stay in your car. See, we were stupid. We got out of a car. We didn't use our heads, and look what happened. We may have won the battle, but the early bird got the worm. Yeah, well, first he goes on to say millennials and Generation Z might wonder why Gen X could be so tasteless and shocking in our humor. And, you know, try having your formative years saved by sketch comedy like National Lampoon or Gary Larson's Far Side or Sam Kinison, George Carlin, Eddie Murphy, and Richard Pryor and see how many sacred cows remain unscathed. I'm sure by the politically correct, my generation looks like it was raised by wolves, says Jim Garrity. But the thing is that he recalls another Living Color sketch which depicted whites rioting after a jury acquitted the attackers of Reginald Denny, and the sketch was funny because of the inherent absurdity. Wealthy, comfortable white people don't burn down their own neighborhoods, no matter how angry they are, but they express it in another way. And he goes on to say, how do white people riot? And they riot by eliminating affirmative action so that jobs and education will be more readily available to whites, by denying, or rather voting to deny services like education and health. And Jim Garrity calls them illegal immigrants instead of undocumented, you know, take it to the juggler, by declaring English as the official language, attacking bilingual education, leaving 38 million people in poverty, 30.6% of all African Americans and 30.7% of all Latinos. White people riot by eliminating 50,000 children from Head Start, by cutting money allotted for summer jobs for inner city youth, which are not necessarily just black, by the way, guess they forgot that, by slashing subsidies for heating bills for poor, cutting homeless assistance, cutting funds for low-income housing, ignoring the 2 million children in California alone who go hungry, and by leaving the minimum wage at 4.25, which is back in the 90s. It has been raised a bit since then. But the point is, that's how they say white people riot, including lowering taxes on capital gains, dumping toxic waste. Okay, there.
So I still don't understand his point.
His point being that if we upset the white ruling culture, the white ruling class, that they riot by turning legislation against us, by turning the economics against us.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. I know. See, my thing is, that's not the riot, that's what we're rioting against. I mean,
okay. Mike. I I'm not sure. I'm still not sure I understand his point. If his point is that the uprising will cause a reaction, then yeah.
Yeah, that's part of his point. The other part being that he thinks this is the backlash. No, not the backlash. He thinks the actions against the police brutality, the toppling of racist and imperialistic and colonialistic statues, and this whole onslaught against white culture is illegitimate. I think that's what he's trying to say. Because I see a lot of dog whistle. I see a lot of dog whistle statements in that whole article. And so...
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's a defense of so-called white culture or white symbols, is he just another angry young white man? Or... And if that's the point, then I understand why it's a National Review. But speaking of the toppling of symbols, I'm sure you are aware of the toppling of statues at the U of O. And last night, the Jefferson statue at Jefferson High School was toppled. Jefferson High School in Portland, Oregon. Symbols of things that are happening throughout the nation, Confederate generals, the call to rename U.S. military bases that are named for traitorous people who rebelled against the United States, which seems to be kind of strange to me.
Jefferson Davis,
a military base against people who fought against you. I have no idea. But part of the, I wonder if part of these ruptures, which may be, you know, maybe some people say are not important, or will, maybe this is what this gentleman was saying in the article, that these toppling of these symbols are going to cause some reaction, and maybe that's not important, but I think it's all part of a larger movement, and that is to re-examine how we interpret our history and how we seek to prepare and create our future. Those are some of my thoughts. Yeah.
So I see it as a statement illegitimizing the attempt for Black Americans to redress the government and redress the white supremacist culture. And one of the things that I find interesting, and we should post that article so people should read it. Is that the things, again, that one of my points is the things that Garrity is complaining about with regard to these protests is he seems to be really narrowly focused and see it as just a riot and a destruction of property and not people being upset over the fact that they're not allowed to even participate in the legislative and the economic process of this country. And so one of the things that I had included in our conversation today was this article about Black people saying, okay, well, this is one thing we can do. This is something that can lead to a different kind of protest, and that is boycotting. So what I wanted to do is open the phone lines today and have a conversation. People are always asking, what can we do? What can we do? Well, as you've heard, one thing you can do is stay on your legislators to make sure they do not do the things that Mr. Garrity listed as the typical responses of white culture, and that is vote against humanity, you know, voting against children, voting against the poor, voting against health care. You can address that by staying on top of your legislators. The other thing is, you want to know what you can do, you can start economically rebuilding by participating in minority economies, by supporting them. And so there are reasons why people have been breaking down property. I haven't been always supportive of that whole ideology, but I saw this video that had a profound effect on me, and it set me to thinking. And it was a young woman explaining how we're not allowed to participate anyway. Every time black business gets a chance to thrive, some ways white culture will interfere with that. And I watched Killer Mike with Trigger Warning. And the very first episode of his series, he decided he wanted to buy black as an adjunct to protest.
Yeah.
And the problem was he couldn't, because he said, we don't focus on our dollar. My thought is, and especially having done some history, examination of some of the history with Portland, is that you can have black-owned businesses, but if the economic elites in your area don't permit it, you can't hold on to your business. It's very difficult. How many people who live in Portland know that at one time, all of the lower southwest parts of Broadway were black-owned businesses that got removed by eminent domain? Or how many people who've lived in Portland know that where the Rose Quarter is, and especially the what is the big square building that's right there on Broadway that used to be where the Blazers and the game was played, and now it moved? I can't remember.
Coliseum?
Yes.
Coliseum? Oh.
Yes. Yes. That bulldozed lots of black homes and businesses. And then there were the black businesses that were up and down Vancouver and Williams that were bulldozed again for eminent domain, and the hospital was put in, and jobs were promised, and they did not happen.
Well, they did. After many years, the hospital did put up a nice display in the lobby talking about that history. So I guess that was reparations. This is how we destroyed a community. So, for those of you who would like to call, we ask you to give us a call at 503-231-8187 and talk about your thoughts about what things are happening, how can people be supportive of black-owned businesses. And there's been a lot that has been going on in our communities of people sharing information about black-owned businesses, how to be supportive of black-owned businesses, and listing, and things are very creative. So in addition to doing the very necessary work of raising your voices and joining with others in mass protests and rallies, what are some things that you are doing that you suggest people can do to create not only an alternative economy, but an alternative world by lifting up the voices and the businesses of those communities which are not centered in our community lives? You are listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with Celeste. I am Cecil. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. Give us a call and let us know your thoughts on this and your reflections on the topics we've raised this morning. And we are longing to hear your wisdoms and the things you have to share with us. In the meantime, I had wanted to go back to Celeste and her sharing of the article from that magazine that was started by William Buckley many years ago. I have possibly another perspective on this, and this is a post by Scott Nakagawa, who wrote this about a few days ago about resistance and the backlash that people will have. But in the meantime, before I go into it, I want to hear the voices of others. 503-231-8187. While we wait for your call, I'll just read this that Mr. Nakagawa posted. He said, it's almost trying to the point of minimization to say that we are living through momentous times, but fresh language escapes me. The rate of change is breathtaking, and the possibility has brought me to tears so many times I've run out of tissues to wipe this knot off my nose. However, yes, it's me again, the guy for whom, however, is a staple vocabulary word. I think this is a time for us, especially us gray hairs, to walk and chew gum at the same time. Yes, embrace the call to action, support the mobilization, give again to the groups who are doing what we must do, taking the risk, leading with their bodies, but also preparing for what comes next. History tells us backlash is on the way. Here's something my cobbled together self-education and civil rights history has taught me. Over 60% of the whites in the U.S. supported civil rights reform and felt the government was not moving fast enough to institute them before 1965. That percentage did a nosedive such that only a minority were in support by the end of the 60s. The reason? Historians tell us that there's a direct connection between the black urban uprisings of the latter half of the 60s and the erosions of white support for civil rights. And Mr. Nakagawa says, I disagree. He continues, the fear and loathsome that those uprisings inspired among non-blacks, not just white people in the U.S., may have played a role, but I think a much more powerful driver of backlash was anxiety over the actual implementation of civil rights reforms. What has once been an abstraction idea became a materially meaningful reality, and the uprising became a means of justifying resistance to concrete rather than abstract change. The dynamic feels to me not dissimilar to the way the media likes to explain white nationalism as a response to fear. We all know that's not what's up. White nationalism is about entitlement and resentment. Fear is just a justification. And so much so that fantasies like Antifa networks spreading across the country to tear up communities in QAnon conspiracy theories are conjured up out of nothing for that purpose. Mr. Nakagawa concludes, I often turn to Eric K. Ward, an intellectual leader in the work I do. Anytime our friend Eric is talking, I'm listening and learning. In the year of the first big wave of Black Lives Matter mobilizations, Eric opened a meeting of foundation heads and social justice advocates in Washington, D.C. by reminding us that each wave of progress we've made on issues of race throughout the history of the U.S. has been met by massive backlash. He warned us that we should heed the lessons of this history. Yes, we should absolutely support the mobilizations. A great deal may be achieved, but we also need to prepare for backlash. Never, ever, ever underestimate the durability and adaptability of racism. If we really believe our own rhetoric about racial capitalism and the enduring power of white supremacy in the U.S., we should proceed under the assumption that backlash is coming. Scott Nakagawa, post he wrote on June 11th.
The numbers here on More Talk Radio are 503-810-7380. You are listening to Your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. I am Celeste Carey. This is Susan Prescott, and we are looking for your call.
We did get a caller. They can't be on the air, but they wanted to know if you could speak about the history of Portland and white supremacy, but then also how it got better, if it got better.
Okay, thank you. That's a little broad of a question. I'm not quite sure what they're looking for. Go ahead, Cecil.
Well, one thing I wanted to refer people to is the history, not only Portland, but also of Oregon. When the white, I'm not sure, if, when white people first came to Oregon and established the state, we need to recognize that Oregon was the first and only state to begin as a whites-only state.
Yes.
Black people were not allowed to settle here. In the Constitution of the United States, exclusion laws were written into it, and those words of the Constitutions were maintained after the state was admitted into the Union, and aspects of it continued. The words remained in the Oregon Constitution until the year 2000. Almost a century and a half after the founding of the state, anti-black words remained in the Oregon Constitution. We all know, well, we may not all know, the history of not only Oregon but Portland, as Celeste alluded to earlier in our conversation about the history of gentrification and that wiped out black neighborhoods in Portland, and that continues today. So what is the future? Are things getting better? I suppose that depends on where you stand or where you sit. The history continues that it is not surprising that Portland remains a very white city. And I think that has something to do with the origins of the state and of the city. And the fact, again, I'm emphasizing that Oregon was established as a white-only state, the only state, the first and only state in the United States. And that history, that legacy, continued in practices throughout the decades, and the difficulty that black people, indigenous people, and people of color have continued to face in this state and in this city. Things are getting better, well, for some, but for too many, it's not.
The fact that you don't have a black business community that is strong and vibrant enough to support the needs of the community is, I think, a major step backwards. Just because you have a few elected officials, you have a few high priority businesses, high visibility businesses, doesn't mean that this has a thriving black enterprise and economy. And for some people who say, well, why do you need a black economy? Well, one reason is because all people have the right to exercise economic security and economic entrepreneurship. And so if people want to serve specific needs that certain ethnic groups and cultures thrive on, why not? And then second, the challenge is why have a white economy if that's how you feel? You know, an economy should satisfy anyone's needs. Anyone should be able to have a business and have customers and meet needs. But I've worked in enough key places in this city to see how many times black businesses and other ethnicities as well, but black businesses here in Portland specifically, have been targeted by either an inordinate amount of citations and alleged violations, or they've been assaulted, such as when I first moved here in 1988. The big challenge in that time was that the police bureau had members take dead possums and throw them in the doorway of a black business. I've seen businesses targeted and called gang businesses because the police decided that it was that way, whether it was or not. And some of these were businesses that I myself had patronized, and so I would know the difference. You know, on occasion, so I would even know the owner through close friends of mine who had grown up in this city with the owner. So, you know, one of the challenges for any group to have self-actualization, to have any measure of self-sufficiency, is to be able to have a business. It's not that black people are not worried about where the dollar is spent. It's that they are not allowed to participate in our economic and entrepreneurial system. And so that's what many times motivates people in a rut to burn down a Target, a Wendy's, or whatever. It's like, you won't let me participate, I will hit you in the pocketbook, because that seems to be the only thing you understand, especially coming out of slave times when black people were property and that was their only value.
Yes. And you mentioned in part of your history in working with black businesses in this town, and I think it's very insightful what you have to say in terms of the challenges that black businesses have faced in terms of regulations, in terms of making it more difficult, in terms of policing around it, and how to maintain a prosperous black business in an economy and in a state where it is so difficult. We must not forget that the black population in Oregon remains at about 2%, very small, and the challenges that black enterprises, black businesses have faced a multitude of challenges that black businesses have faced. So let's mention in terms of the transitions in terms of black districts that have established for a short time, and then either because of urban renewal, you mentioned first in Southwest Portland, where blacks first settled, in part because of the train stations, and they first settled there. There was a movement to get them out of there. Many of us know the history of World War II and the influx of blacks into the region, and the history of Vanport, and later we know of the redlining that took place and the marginalization of black businesses in the albino neighborhood, difficulty to get bank loans for homes and for businesses, the urban renewal, which destroyed black neighborhoods for things, as you suggested, in the Northeast Portland, gentrification that takes place that move black people out of inner Northeast Portland to the so-called numbers, and the continued challenges that and then you challenges in terms of access to services, to good roads, to good schools, and it goes on and on.
We invite your call and conversation, 503-231-8187. I do want to refer people who are interested in history to this publication. It's called Portland's History of, the History of Portland's African American Community from 1805 to the present. It was published in February 1993 by the Portland Bureau of Planning, and it's Portland's albino community. It is a copy. What do you call these? It's a pamphlet. You can open it. You can also find it online. If you go to https://sos.oregon.gov/archives/exhibits/black-history. I think it'd be better if you just do a search into the history of Portland's African American community, because it'll come up quicker. But that's one of the booklets that when my former colleagues Judith Maurer and John Kanda and I did the restorative listening circle on gentrification years ago, this is one of the pieces of documentation and history and information that we used to share. And so when you hear people talking about, well, we would buy black if we could, they would bounce longer in our neighborhood if it could, well, this is part of the reason why. You'll find it in this booklet.
Right. And also, just to expand the conversation about the history of blacks in Oregon, I'll refer you to the writer. I believe we've had her on the program, Pearl Alice Marsh, who wrote the history about her family, black loggers in Wallola. County and that history, which is often forgotten or unknown. And so thank you so much for Dr. Pearl Alice Marsh for documenting the history of blacks in Oregon.
Yes. And so, you know, again, if people are wrong, there's even this idea of buy black, you know, you have to have your wealth circulate among your groups, whether it's a socioeconomic group or, you know, a gendered group or ethnic or racial group, so that you can have collective power, you can have collective self-determination. And if you study how money moves in other communities, you'll see that that's one of the reasons that they are able to thrive in various areas. And for those who don't know why there was even a black economy, that came out of segregation when black people weren't being served.
You know, you mentioned money, and I think this is a good time to interject. We have a caller, Boris, wanted to mention if he could go back to the boycotting part of the conversation, and he did draw parallel lines between the BDS movement, that is been a movement to basically not buying products that were made in Israel or in the illegal settlements in the region, and how that has actually created a lot of waves to the point that there's actual legislation. And so he did want to mention that the boycott could be an interesting route, and if he could talk about that as well.
Okay, well, one of the things that I received through family and friends is that there has been a big call for a national blackout. It's a national economic withdrawal boycott. It kicks off on Juneteenth. June 19th is Friday, and you celebrate Juneteenth first. For those who don't know what Juneteenth is, I did touch on it a little bit last week. It was when the slaves in Texas finally were actually set free, because prior to that, they were not told they'd been set free by the end of the Civil War, the Emancipation Proclamation. It was 2 years before they were set free. You want to know why black people are suspicious of government. Anyway, starting on June 21st, you're supposed to boycott big chains and department stores like Walmart or Sam's or Target. Monday the 22nd, boycott fast food and chain restaurants, McDonald's, Popeyes, Hip Hop, Checkers, whatever. Tuesday, boycott online shopping, no Amazon, Fashion Nova, etc. Wednesday the 24th, boycott supermarkets. Thursday the 25th, repeat days 1 and 2, which are big chain and fast food, big fast foods. Friday 3 and 4, which is online shopping and supermarkets. And day 7, that Saturday the 27th, it says do not spend any money at all, period. But here's the thing. Any day of the week, you can shop at local black-owned businesses and farmers markets and what have you, and do all of your shopping, forget what you need before these days, before the boycott starts. But you can shop any black-owned businesses that any day. That's local black-owned businesses, farmers markets, etc. So, you know, we can do this, and we can continue to do this, but this is not a we can do this by ourselves thing. So when my white friends and allies and accomplices and all the other names we give people who actually care and want to know what they can really do, this is one thing you could do, is you can start supporting black businesses, but not just black businesses. When coronavirus first kicked off, racism reared its ugly head by not shopping at Asian businesses. And the sad part about it is, as we know, there is, I'm trying to find a nice diplomatic way to say this, but there is no gain in blaming the ordinary person for anything as major and global as a pandemic. Usually that's the effort of larger forces, you know. So your Asian market on the corner, your friends, the random person you met on the street, were not the cause of coronavirus. And people getting in people's faces and all of this backlash was the effect of a small mind. So what I'm saying essentially is, yes, please support black businesses, but come out of that whole idea of ignoring minority businesses and support minority businesses. Because if you support a minority business in your community especially, you make the entire community stronger. That's what happens. But anyway, 503-231-8187 is the phone number. Join us in the conversation. Tell us ways that you find support the stronger, broader effort of these protests, and especially in economic terms.
We do have... Go ahead. So we do have another comment and a question. Linda called and did want to mention that the Oregon Historical Quarterly does have an issue on white supremacy and resistance in Oregon, and it's it was actually another program that was on KABU discussing it. But that is a really interesting read, and it goes like in depth into a lot of different regions in Portland, in Oregon. Another caller called in, and they wanted to highlight the double standard of calling in the military on American people, and if you could talk about the double standard of when different types of people protest throughout America, and why it seems like when Black people are protesting for human rights, the military seems to be called in. That was specifically toward Cecil.
Well, okay. Thank you for the call, this for Cecil. You know, that wasn't what it was, but I'm going to defer to my co-host to answer that.
Okay. Well, I think it's very insightful to look at how and when the military is called in, and there's that that history of attacking Black people, and the whether it's the National Guard or militarized police, there's that impact. I think it's also important to be aware of that the military is supposed to not be a domestic army, but is supposed to defend the country against foreign enemies.
Mm-hmm.
So when we have the military use against citizens or residents of the United States, that's a usurping of the role of the military, and I guess constitutional lawyers can argue that. But it also means it reveals an attitude that the government may have for people living in the United States. One should not be surprised if Black people who were once viewed and treated and traded as property can be seen in the latter day as the enemy, again, as the other. And as long as you have the other, whether the other is as property or as the enemy, it is very easy, I think, for the government to use any means they have to maintain control, the ongoing legacy of life in the U.S. Those are some of my thoughts.
We are always considered other, and that's why we here go back to where you come from. Why do you name your kids these strange sounding names? Why can't you just be like us? And, you know, even though this isn't the topic specifically, one thing that makes the request important is the fact that as property, it kind of echoes the idea that we have no rights. You know, many people either view us still as some subhuman species or as property that's gotten out of hand. You know, we're uppity. Property should never be uppity. Property should be deferred and quiet. But we want to thank people for the calls that we've gotten, even though they weren't discussion, so to speak. And again, if you want to help with the protest, if you want to help change things, there's two things. Support minority businesses, especially right now, support Black businesses, because it's very evident what the elite thinks of us. And we don't want that idealism of, I mean, that idea of the white supremacy culture to trickle down to our everyday white brothers and sisters and neighbors and friends. Support black businesses and keep your legislators honest. This is your community connection, KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.